Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
1-800, there's a fly in the studio. I like to kill it. I can't get to it. Don't you hate flies when they get... And I'm the kind of guy that lets flies out of a window, if I can. There's no windows here, no screens. I want to just kill it with a newspaper. In 2 minutes, you're going to hear me running after a fly. I hate flies. I hate them. They remind me of liberals. They always buzz around. They leave fecal matter everywhere. They supply nothing positive to the environment. You know, they're always buzzing, buzzing, buzzing. A bee, I don't even mind as much as a fly. A bee, I never get, it doesn't bother me because I can see a bee. It doesn't weave and bob like a fly. A fly has a certain agility that a bee doesn't. Bees leave you alone, by and large. A fly looks to bother you just because it can. My father taught me a trick, may rest in peace. You take an undershirt off your body. It's an old European trick, and you swing it overhead. You ever see the old men do that years ago? There's no old men around anymore. Where are the old men in this country? You never see them. When I grew up, there were old men around. There were old men, middle-aged men, young men. Today, everyone tries to look alike. With Viagra and hair transplants, it's like one continuum from age 15 till death. Everyone has dark hair, false teeth. And are sexually, they can be sexually aroused till they go into the coffin. My day, you got old, and that was the end of it. They were old, younger though. The truth is, in my day, 40 was 60, 60 was 40, 80 was 60. I don't know how it happened. So, like a 60-year-old today is like a 40-year-old then, right? And in those days, they died young at 50, 55. A lot of them, it was like 75, 78. Well, they ate like they didn't know what they were doing. You ever take a look at their diets? Smoked all day, didn't exercise, didn't take a vitamin, no diet, never heard of a garlic. They drank the wrong alcohol, you know. So, you know, you can kill any good genetic inheritance with that kind of situation. You could see I'm already, you know what I really want to do is have fun. I am having fun. Maybe it's too much fun. Maybe you want me to just do pure, you know, stuff for you. I don't know. I'm not in the mood. I have a friend I heard that I know from 30 years ago, listens to the show avidly in New York. Now, I haven't spoken to him in 20 years, but I heard he listens. And he actually knows that I really, when I told the story of the midget in the seedy hotel in Florida from 25 years ago, there really was a midget, and he really did rob all of my money and his money, and we had to call the police, and the police were in on the take. Remember that story? AC, if you're listening to this show, would you call and confirm that there was a midget in that Fleabag hotel in Miami back in the 60s? It really did exist. I was a naive kid from New York. We took the Greyhound bus down to Florida. We couldn't even afford a $69 air ticket. So it was like intercession, and we took the – what bus were we? Greyhound, probably. Greyhound bus to Florida. I remember to this day went on – it was like Midnight Cowboy, right? It was like Midnight Cowboy. I mean, you know, like through Atlanta, there were like chicken bones in the aisle already. People were throwing food on it. You're like eating chicken and throwing it on the floor. It got so filthy. Who would use a, you know, you really have to be a hero to use a Greyhound toilet. I would never. I'd rather bust inside than. Imagine going into a bus toilet in this day and age. Imagine what kind of needles are in there or whatever. I never, even as a kid, I wouldn't use a bus toilet. My God, the thought of it. The driver was like, he was telling you there's a restroom in the back of the bus? Forget about it. It's like apartheid, man. Take that bus. It was the best fried chicken I ever tasted in my life was, you know, what do I know? Everything with me is food. So I came from New York, and my mother would try to make fried chicken. It was okay, but I didn't like the oil. It didn't taste good. So I figured I'm in Atlanta at the bus stop. I'll try in the cafeteria, the Greyhound cafeteria in Atlanta. Now, I'm going to try the cuisine of the South in this place. What did I know? I was a kid from New York. I had no idea. I figured, all right, I'm in the South. I'm going to try Southern Fried Chicken. Where am I going to try it? The Greyhound bus terminal. It was excellent. It was unbelievable. Those days, there was no KFC. They do a pretty good job, KFC. I've told you that. I haven't eaten it for a while. I got to try it again. I need to, like a hand. Maybe that's why I have a skin condition, not enough grease. You know, I bet you I cut down on the fats too much. My skin became tight. Maybe if I had a high-fat diet. You know what? What if I went to a high-cholesterol diet for a few days? I went and got the fish oil today. The Norwegian, the nitrogen-infused $18 variety of cod liver oils from special hippie fish from Norway. Fish that are, they're all socialists. They're not racist. They're not homophobic fish. They danced in certain aquariums. And then they were harvested peacefully in their old age. And their livers were extracted gently by Dr. Death from his jail cell and infused with nitrogen. I actually feel better from it, the fish liver oil. But I don't like it. I grew up on it. Thank God I had fish liver oil as a child. I got to tell you the truth. With the diet I ate, what she put into my mouth, you know how they force feed a goose to make pate? I was close to second in a human form. Well, because they came from poverty in the old world, so they had a little money. The first thing they did was feed you. They didn't intend to give you a heart attack at 12. But it was a cardiotoxic diet. There's no question about it. Ham and eggs for breakfast, meatloaf, a light lunch meatloaf from the night before. And at night, you had a steak or pot roast polished off with an ice cream. Now, if you do that to an average human being today, they're dead in 3 years. Let's say you wanted to take Al-Qaeda members, and you say, well, here's your choice. We're either going to keep you in prison indefinitely with no charges for another 10 years, or we can subject you to Michael Savage's childhood diet for 3 months. And if you don't get a heart attack, you're free. You know what I'm saying? It's a choice. Now, the reason I think I'm still alive is twofold. A, I inherited on the FEMA, the maternal side of the genetics. And B, was the cod liver oil. Because despite the cardiotoxic diet, she gave me cod liver oil. She made me take drops. It was like in a dropper bottle in orange juice. I hated it. I hated the taste of it. It was so disgusting. To this day, it was like remembrances of disgusting things past. It was like Proust in the negative. Drip, drip, take it, it's good for you. I hated it. Take it or I'll kill you. And the scissors came out, or the big knife from the drawer. The Soprano scissors were looked at. Her eyes crossed, and I knew I better take that orange juice with the it was less than getting a good wallop, you know, if I didn't take the juice. It was like the Kool-Aid. You look back on these things, it's lucky I didn't wind up in Guyana with Jim Jones. You know, take my Kool-Aid, man. Here's the drops in the Jell-O, you know. What am I talking about? Do some of you, are you able to follow free association when I get into the jazz thing of the show, or should I stop it? Would you like two dimensions, one dimension, or seven dimensions? You got to tell me what you want me to do here. On the line is a guy I have not spoken to in 10, 15 years, but he knows that the one-eyed midget from Miami story is 100% true. AC, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael.
I don't believe it. It's you. It really is you. I cannot believe it. I heard the other day that you are a listener.
A guy called me. He says, you better call your buddy Mike Savage. He says you should call him. Some bartender called me, the very same guy from 6-7 months ago. Mike, the big question is, do you remember how much money you put in the safe in Florida?
No! How much did I... Wait, I'm going to guess. In those days, $35, my entire life savings.
Bingo!
No. Are you serious? Was it 35 bucks?
We put in the money in the morning. We came back 6 o'clock. He didn't know what you were talking about.
Was it not a midget in a shredded midget suit, like a bellhop?
23rd and Collins, man.
23rd and Collins. So is that South Beach today, Arnie?
Well, you know, South Beach, they want to say, is below 21st Street. So it's not officially South Beach, but it's South Miami.
Okay, but did you have bed bugs in your bed?
Of course.
I woke up in the morning, I thought I was hallucinating. There were bed bugs in the hotel. Now, today, I'll bet you that property's worth a pretty penny, no doubt.
But, Mike, you don't remember. You went crazy with the guy. All of a sudden, he immediately found it, or he forgot. He found it.
Wait a minute. Let's slow down. We put the money in, all our money, in the safety deposit box in this flea-bag hotel. We come back. I don't know about no money. I went crazy. Didn't we call for the police?
We threatened to call for the police. The midget eyes started rolling around in his head, the one eye. And all of a sudden, he remembered it was in the back safe.
Oh, I pulled a loud yelling scene in the lobby, right?
Went nuts.
I gave him the command voice and the insanity, and the midget suddenly saw reality. He vaguely remembered the money. Oh, I switched to the other box or something, right? That's right. It reappeared before the police arrived.
Reappeared. All of a sudden, he apologized profusely. What can I say? It was incredible. It was.
See, but people think I made up the midget in the Miami hotel story. What else? Is it not true, and I won't get too personal, didn't you have an uncle who owned a hotel down there, a rich guy?
You got some memory.
Wait, yes or no? Didn't he own a hotel?
Mickey Hayes, he...
Oh, my... But didn't he also have a slight habit of stealing the sugar out of other hotels? I remember he owned a hotel worth millions in those days. Even in those days, millions, which could be, you know, God knows what today. But he had a habit. The sugar and the butter he took from other hotels.
And the plastic spoons.
That's right. You never knew when you might need them because he could be thrown out of Florida any minute. So without getting into details, I hear you're happily remarried and everything now. I won't get into details.
Michael, I have been wanting to call you for the longest time. I just never, I don't know what to say, but now I get phone calls, call you
up.
Oh,
no, now we're at, now the next time you're on the West Coast, it's dinner on me. We're going to have a good laugh. Because as I get older, I realize, I mean, time, tick-tock. You know, you can't invent old friends, my friend AC.
And you know this, you know, are we on the radio now? Because I don't even know, but...
I hope so. If we're not, I'm out of business.
Let me tell you this. There's one thing, I mean, I go over my Michael's, the times we had together. Why can't I get Hakka cuisine here on the East Coast?
Isn't that amazing? From the years you lived in San Francisco?
You took me on Broadway to the Hakka cuisine. There was all...
Oh, yeah, no, you cannot get Hakka in New York with that Chinese community? You never heard of a Hakka?
All I know is you turned me on to the greatest Chinese food in the world, Hakka.
Well, San Francisco has the best Chinese food in the world. There's no question about it. And Hakka cuisine is at the top of the list. It's in the clay pots and the this and that. You know, before you go, I remember one of the best memories of my life in San Francisco was when you lived here before the horrible, and I can't bring it up, let's forget it with the taxi thing, right?
Michael, there's not enough time that we have now. You're on your show.
But
around.
But I was there for you, wasn't I? Was I not there for you?
You showed up to see that I was still alive. I had the apartment on 17th Avenue. I couldn't even go to the bathroom. My hands were all in casts.
Oh, I'd like to. That is that where? Let's not go into that person. I'm sure he's a board of supervisor today. Do you remember the dinner your former paramour threw in that wonderful apartment? A long Sicilian dinner. She had. Remember, she was from Sicily, right? A lovely girl. And she did an Italian meal. Remember I asked for like a Godfather meal and she did it with like 20 people at a long table. Remember that meal?
Fabulous.
See that? I remember all the good stuff. It's all simple things, AC. Let me tell you.
There's so much. And they asked me what music I wanted to play. And I was all of a sudden, I nutted up. You don't play any Latin music for them on the air, do you? They wouldn't understand.
Oh, yes, I do. Once in a while from the private collection. Our old friend Artie sends me CDs I play. Play Power of a View while AC is on. Let's see if it makes him go. It means to life, and to you I say to life. God bless you. Thank God you're still with us on this planet.
Savage.
I bicycle to a mall. I normally don't eat at the mall. I just bicycle there for exercise and to look at people. To gape at the fools of Marin County, to see boys being raised as girls, to see girls being raised as boys, to see children being raised to have their throats cut as the enemy raises their children to kill and cut throats. We raise our children to be sensitive and compassionate. So you see little boys walking around like girls with long hair, practically swishing at age 7, with the mother approving of the little girl she's raising in a boy's body. I don't say anything, I just watch. I'm merely an observer. And I wonder, where are we going to get a generation of men who can shoot guns and kill them before they kill us? I don't know. They're going to come out of the middle. I don't know where they're going to come. So then I was hungry. I didn't want to go home and make a tuna fish sandwich before going to the radio station. So I go into this French cafe. Now, you understand that I made a mistake going in. It's been there for 2 years. I've never eaten there. I wasn't in the mood for a meal. I figured I'd have a salad. So I figured it's a bistro French, but I knew it was going to be bad. I go in right away. I said, give me the French onion soup. Is it ready? Yes, the Mexican says. I said, all right, give me a salad. Is it ready? 2 minutes. I'm outside. 10 minutes, nothing. I go in with my number. I said, hey, I said I have to go to work. Trabajo, work. Where's the onion soup? Oh, it's coming, senor. I said, if it doesn't come now, give me my money back. I got to go to work. So then they bring me the soup. Need I tell you what they do to cheat people? French onion soup, the broth, must cost 1 cent per cup, if it costs that. The bowl, which was $4.99, had bread in it, some cheese, and 1 spoon of broth at the bottom of the bread. So I said, I can't believe this. I just can't believe they would do this to people. And I'm hungry. I mean, it wasn't the money. I called for the manager, who was a white guy, a skinny French twerp. And I said, do you manage this restaurant? I said, nicely, yes, sir. I said, look, there was a spoon of broth. You see, you picked the bread up. There's nothing there. Yes, sir. I said, don't put any more bread in there. Just give me broth. He brings it back. He says, I refilled your bowl. I look in it again. Full of bread. I pull the bread out. There's 2 spoons of broth. You know what I did? I ate it and left. Because that's what it is. But what do you expect from the French, particularly French in Marin County, California, who know they can get away with murder because the people are like their sons. The people are like their sons, living in a bubble of stupidity, not understanding the danger they are in, not comprehending that the little psychotic Hitler of Iran will kill them all unless he is killed first, not comprehending that radical Islam is here, it is near, it is everywhere, not comprehending that the radical right wing, as expressed by Michael Savage, is their best friend, not comprehending a damn thing about reality, living in a dream world, not comprehending the danger they are in, I said to myself.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
WOR in New York, Vinny, you're on The Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Topic is family, Michael.
Yes.
And family, I want to go back to the 50s. I'm 62 years old. I was the last of 16 kids. I'm blind.
Wait, you come from a family of 16 children? My God.
I am the last of 16 children. I was born in 1945. I had, we lived in, Michael, in Glen Cove. It's on Long Island.
Oh, yes.
We lived in 5 rooms, Michael, not 5-bedroom house, 5-room house.
Yeah, now hold on. Did you say you're blind?
I was born with glaucoma, Michael, and then at the age of 6, I lost my eyesight in both eyes.
Oh, my God. So how were you raised in this huge family in a small house? How were you treated?
I'm going to tell you right now. And this is an important story because I'm doing my whole life story. This is very important. And this is based on what I got from my mother, my father, in the 50s.
Right.
It was a tough family, tough Italian neighborhood called the Orchard. Tough, tough, tough. We grew up with a lot of abuse, a lot of dysfunction, this kind of thing. My father, 5'2", Michael, 115 pounds, kept the family together. He was a monster of a man.
Yeah, he ruled with an iron fist, and I guarantee he beat the kids up pretty good, too, when they stepped out of line.
He beat my ass good when I needed, blind or no blind. And that's
what I was going to ask you. Even though you were blind, you didn't get special treatment.
No. No, my father knew the deal. The deal was I had to eventually learn what life was all about. And it wasn't about coddling the little blind kid.
You know, it's funny. I had the same lecture over and over again, the coddling. He used to hate if my mother would be soft, treat me like nice. He'd scream, you're going to ruin the kid. Don't treat him like blah, blah, blah. I'm sure you heard the same thing.
Same thing. My mother, leave the baby. What are you doing? No. I don't want to hear it. No.
He's got to learn. And, you know, so we used to sleep, Michael, 3 and 4 in a bed. We had rats in the walls scratching at our heads. I mean, this was poverty, beyond poverty. The early 50s, okay? Mm. We had we didn't have a bathroom. We had a room with a toilet bowl and a stack of newspapers. I mean,
wait a minute. What do you mean no bathroom? Did you have, like, a toilet like in The Godfather with a pull chain on the top?
No. I don't
know. You were advanced. You actually had a flush toilet that you didn't have to pull from the thing overhead where Sonny put the gun behind for him, for Michael.
No. In a little room.
All right, so let me ask you, how did you go forward in life if you were blind?
I'm going to tell you. This was tough. Now, I was lost. I had nothing to cling to. My mother, unfortunately, was an alcoholic, and I had to deal with this. She barely sent me to school. My father was the one to keep me straight. My father was the one to try to help me. My father, when he got to play bocce ball, took me with him. He knew I needed special attention. He worked on an estate. He would take little chicks home.
So he was a caretaker on an estate?
He would take little chicks home. He would take me to the estate. Let me touch the horses. Let me touch the chickens. He knew, this man knew what I needed.
Isn't that something? Wait, let's pause. This is very touching. So he didn't have to go to a PhD psychologist from New York State to tell him how to raise a blind child.
Yeah.
Somehow your father, who was not an educated man, knew that you needed to touch things because you couldn't see him. How'd he figure that out?
My father was born in Calabria, Italy, and he was in the fields at 5 years old working. And he came to America, married my mother. My mother was 12 when he married her.
Oh, my God. What a story. I don't want to... So the first child was at 13?
Yes.
Oh, my God. What a story.
And my father, in the middle of all this, Michael, and this is so important, man, when you listen to the garbage of the, you know, the political nonsense and this chick dropping dead, who cares? Are you kidding
Nothing.
Me? Nothing.
I don't care. Well, and you want to... The son died this last summer, another drug overdose. Can you imagine one produced another?
Michael, I'm not going to say show business. I'm a musician, singer, professionally since 59, 60.
Wait a minute. I don't believe this. Wait a minute. Despite the fact that you were blind, you're a professional musician?
I've traveled. I've gone to Europe many times. I've traveled all over this country.
Isn't that amazing? What do you sing, Vinny?
I'm a blues singer, Michael. I'm doing a Ray Charles tribute show.
There's so many elements here. Today, if God forbid you were born that way, the state already would send some expert moron from a university who would ruin your life, turn you into a cripple.
I want to say something to you. I hate to interrupt, but this is so important.
No, we're having a conversation. You're not interrupting. I'm excited by the call.
My first opportunity to talk to my hero, you are the voice and the light in this darkness called life. I'm serious. You're honest. You're the truth.
You're making me almost cry. Don't do it because I had a blind brother. I don't even want to do it. I feel like I'm talking to the past. I can't do this. I'm almost going to get too emotional from this because I don't know you, Vinny, but I feel like I know you, Vinny.
Well, I know you because we grew up in the same way. It was the tough way. Now,
yeah, but you're a blind person, so you have a different set of senses than the average person. Not only can you not see me, but you can only hear my voice in the radio. So you've come to feel that you know me, don't you?
You know what I hear from you, Mike? I hear truth, soul, heart, honesty.
You also hear a man screaming out in the wilderness to be saved from the monstrosity called government.
Listen, I listen to the rest of the idiots on radio. This is all show business. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. You are the only one.
But wait, let's go back to you. Forget me. I don't want to talk about me, Vinny. I want to know, and I never thought this call would come through, how did you go from being a blind kid in a dysfunctional large family like this without a dime turn into a musician? How did your father lead you from petting a horse while you're blind and touching a little chick, a chicklet, you know, a little baby bird, so that people don't think I'm making a joke here? How did you become a singer?
My father said to me, you need to make music a part of your life. You need to listen to music. He was a musician. He played guitar. He played harmonica. He would sing to me. He would sit me on his lap.
God.
You know the old-fashioned lunch boxes with the handles? He
yes.
would play drums. He would make that a drum and sing to me. And he said, you have to listen with your heart to music. You need music more than you need your eyesight.
Wait, how did your father, an uneducated man, know all this? How did he know that a blind child needed music? Who taught him this?
I thank him for that. He knew.
Yeah, he was a very special man, your father. Let's start with that. And Vinny, you know something? This is the part about the average man that always impresses me, is that you never know what the average man is capable of until he's pressed to perform in a certain way. Some people become monsters and others become so noble it's incomprehensible. You know what I'm saying, Vinny?
My father raised and supported all these kids. My father was dealing, unfortunately, with an alcoholic wife.
Yeah, but your father didn't run away and say, I can't handle it, did he? He didn't run off and leave the kids alone.
Are you kidding me? Let me tell you what my father used to do, Michael, and I remember this. The kids used to sit down to eat. He would not eat until everything was done and they were all finished. And whatever was left, then he would eat.
Oh, my God. What a man. How old was your father when he passed away?
96, Michael.
Oh, my God. So despite the deprivation, despite the hardship, despite the poverty, without any help from the government, the man lived a full life on top of it all?
He worked, Michael, until he was 93.
Whoa.
93, Mike, he was a bull. And then at 93, on the job, he had a stroke. And
he drank a little wine, I hope, at night?
Oh, he drank red wine, man, big time.
Yeah, but I knew an Italian guy that was around the family in my father's store. He would drink about a gallon of homemade red wine every night. I'm talking a gallon. Would you believe it, Vinny? These guys really drank. They didn't sip wine. They drank wine.
He went to work with a big bottle of wine, red wine, that he made, of course, and cheese. Cheese and wine, that was his thing. Then he'd come home. After the kids ate, he would sit down, have more wine. Red wine kept this man going. Michael, he used to do things like, you know, these little personal things that nobody else would probably relate to but me. There was a butcher shop right up the street, and in those days, we used to get snails, okay?
Yeah, like escargot, the French eat snails. I understand it.
Okay, they were 10 cents a pound. I loved them.
The only difference is in Hollywood, they get the snails in their bare feet.
You got it.
So you bought the snails, then what?
I love it. He'd buy the snails, put them in a pot, make the sauce, blah, 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 boom, me and him in the front yard, and he'd lay them all out, and him and I used to eat. I mean, that was part of his...
So did he love you more than the other children because you were blind? Did he have he felt more for you?
Special feeling for me. But you know what he knew, Michael, now that I'm a grown-up and I look back at this? He had this incredible wisdom and soul and heart to know that the other ones could take care of themselves. They could see they're all physically fine. This little boy needed some special attention and needed some serious guidance. And my father gave me what took me through life. He gave me music. Let me just tell you, Michael, after he talked to me about music, I started to listen. I'm a drummer, singer, Michael.
Now, Vinny, tell me how you became a singer and a musician. In your world, you didn't have anyone from the state education department teaching you. Did you go to a regular school?
I barely went to school for years in my early young childhood because my mother was drinking, and I would spend most of my time just sitting in the front yard of my the front yard, just listening to the sounds of the neighborhood. Until the school really cracked down on my mother and said, you have to send them to school or they're going to take them away from you.
Yes.
It wasn't easy. It was tough. I didn't know where.
But they didn't teach you to become a musician in school. Your father did.
No. So let me tell you what happened. My father talks to me, and he sings to me, and he says, music, feel it in your heart. You don't need eyesight. You have to feel. You have to feel. He knew I wasn't going to see. He knew that the blindness was, you know, something that we were looking for, but he wanted to prepare me in case it never happened. There was a luncheonette right down the street, and they had a jukebox and used to pump music out into the orchard. The sound would come, and I would listen, and I got two forks from my mother's drawer, and I tapped on the front.
Vinny, stay with us, please.
Savage. We'll be right back.
magic has me in its spell.
Oh, black magic that you weave so well.
Those icy fingers up and down my spine.
It is the Savage Nation. You got to hear this story. Just let me hear this for a minute. I want to hear Louis Prima and Healy Smith.
That I feel inside.
And then that elevator.
Where do all these people go? What happened to them?
Down and down I go.
Round and around I go.
Like what a voice.
Caught in a tight.
Bing.
Anyway, we're talking on the show, nostalgia, this, that, if you just tuned in. I got to tell you something. So a guy calls him named Vinny from New York, 16th child, poor Italian family. He's blind, and he has a father who's basically uneducated, who raises him to become a musician and teaches him in a way that psychologists listening to the show could learn from. So now I got to tell you what just happened. We had scheduled for this particular slot a very fine congressman, Representative Culberson of Texas, to talk about the travesty going on with the Border Patrol agents. And we begged him. My producer called and said, please understand, we got Vinny on. You know what the congressman said to show you how great this congressman is? He says, I'm listening to your show. Go, Vinny, go. I want to hear it too. I mean, this is a real man. We get the best callers, the best guests in the country. I got to tell you, I'm very happy. So I'm on Vinny's website now. It's VinnySaintMartin.com, V-I-N-N-Y. S-T-M-A-R-T-E-N.com. And you go on, it says Vinny St. Martin and the Seeing Eye Dog Band. And there's a picture of him with dogs. And listen to this. And then we're going to go back to the good-looking blind guy. He says, from the time he discovered his mother's cookware, Vinny St. Martin filled his world with music. For years, I drove my family crazy using forks and spoons to bang on pots and pans as I listened to music on the radio. It got so bad that my family hid all the silverware from me. So in the middle of the night, I found 2 4-pound jars of coffee, dumped the coffee down the toilet, and taped the jars together. It was my first pair of bongos. We were so poor that my mother couldn't afford to hire a plumber. She spent hours plunging the toilet and screaming at me. Vinny, that's a true story, I assume.
I have stories, Michael, you have no idea.
You know, Vinny, I got to tell you, although I lived in the Bronx as a little boy, across the street there was a farm. To this day, I can tell you, the first rose I ever saw was growing on a vine on the fence to that little farm, and we would climb the fence just to smell the roses. And I couldn't believe how delicate the petals felt to my hand. I had never seen anything as soft in my life. I'm sure you could relate to that.
I can totally relate to that. In my neighborhood, there was, remember pussy willows?
Yes, sir.
That, to touch a pussy willow was one of the most exciting feelings. They were so, it was like cotton. If you remember how pussy willow felt.
Vinny, you were born with glaucoma, which was very rare. And you say your condition was written about in several medical journals. You said you had recurring cataracts and endured 12 eye surgeries. My poor brother had cataract surgery till he died. He used to rip our guts out every time they tried it. But it says in 1956 he received one of the first corneal transplants on the East Coast. There were newspaper articles, television, even a marriage bill. But however, the operation was not successful. And so music saved you, in plain English. So, Vinny, what do you do now?
I was going in for this corneal transplant. I was 12 years old, and they operated, and 3 days later, the doctor comes down and examines my eye and looks with the little examining light, and it's the first light I saw in, like, 6 years, 5 years, and they thought it was going to be okay. So I had to stay in bed. I couldn't get out of bed for 2-3 weeks, and one of the nurses changing the bed accidentally elbowed my eye.
Oh, God.
And they took me upstairs, and that was the end of that. But, of course, in those days...
What do you mean? That was the last time you saw any light at all?
But Michael, remember this. At that point in my life, I had music in my life. I wanted music. I had the musical dream. My father placed those musical seeds in me. I didn't care about the eyesight because you know what happened, Michael? They removed my right eye when I was a little boy, 3 years old, 4 years old. My left eye, some days it would be good, some days it was more aggravating to try to see. So I wanted to get it over with and get on with my music.
Right. Vinny, what message do you want to leave the audience with?
The message is this. We're all here on a special path, and we're all here if we can get to the point in our lives where we can focus not on ourselves, but on other people to give. Michael, let me just tell you, my blindness has been the greatest gift of my life. I wouldn't trade my blindness for all the money in the world.
I don't know what else to do, Vinny. I know that this is not the last time you and I are going to talk. And with God's will and intervention, you and I are going to meet at some point. I'm sure you don't come out to the West Coast much, or do you?
Come out to the West Coast to meet you in a heartbeat. But
well, if I do an event, for sure, Vinny, in an event. But, I mean, I'm going to have you on the stage. If I do an event, it's got to be Vinny St. Martin and the Seeing Eye Dog Band. I got to see this one. But, Vinny, until then, God bless you. Thank you for permitting me to go with you to another time and another place, and perhaps some of the young people listening to this show were inspired in some way to have a family if they were afraid, to understand that, you know, here, Vinny, again, we're going to not stop talking for a minute. I can't shut up with you. I hear a lot of young guys say, oh, the times are too terrifying to have children. Oh, it's too cloudy a future to have children. And I say to them, what, in the 50s it was a sure thing that the kids were jumping under desks afraid of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union? And I said, in World War II, in the concentration camps, people were having children while their friends were being tortured to death by the Nazis. They had children. And the Middle Ages people had children during the Black Plague. What do you mean the times are too tough? That's no excuse, Vinny. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. Where do you find a 5'2", 115-pound man?
What was your father's name, his full Italian name, Vinny?
Salvatore Bazile. My middle name is San Martin. I just kind of Americanized it. Maybe.
Oh, I was wondering how you got the last name. Well, let's toast your dad tonight in heaven. And Vinny, we'll be friends again. The guys are going to keep your phone number, and we'll speak again. I'll be right back. I'm running so late. It's a pleasure. I'll be right back on the Savage Nation.
Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The dog is not in the studio today. He's getting a bath. And I don't know, maybe I'm getting, I don't know, maudlin. I thought about him dying. And he's 2 years old, but this is the whole thing about life. It's that whole Buddhist wheel thing. And you feel it more acutely sometimes with an animal than you do with a human being. It's a strange thing. I buried a father, I buried a mother, I buried a brother. You know, all of it breaks your heart and you never get over any of it. But the animals, I don't know, there's something about them that's so different than people. Don't get me wrong, they're not better, and I know about the gradation of importance. Believe me, I haven't lost my mind altogether. I'm not Al Gore, after all. But the fact of the matter is, you think of this innocent creature, never hurt a soul. And I got a box upstairs with the other dog in it, the ashes, Snowy. I mean, I don't want to get you crazy here, but you start to wonder, then you look at your own flesh, and you realize that this is God's plan, and this is how he wants it. Otherwise, you would have been a god yourself. He didn't want you to be immortal. He wanted you to be mortal so you'd understand that you have a short period of time to act on the stage and do it right and get it right the first time, or you're going to come back 1,000 more times or whatever. And you may not come back even in the form that you were in. You might come back as a cockroach next time, or even worse, the mayor of San Francisco. You can never tell. But I thought a little Teddy, you know, I just don't think I can take this one. And I, you know, it's like he's 2 and he could live to 12 and that's it. I don't think I could deal with another set of ashes in a box. Because, you know, I'm going to watch him get old and I don't want to. Anyway, I got to breed him. That's all. I got to have a bunch of little teddies. I was thinking about that. You know, that's reproduction. That's the whole deal. make little teddies and keep a few of them, like people do with their dogs. You ever seen people with like two or three dogs say, like, who's that? Well, that's his mother, that's his father, that's his brother. I used to like that. But they were like other people who could have that many dogs. I never could. We were like always a one-dog family. You know, there were people always had like three or two. And yeah, that's his mother. And you, oh, really? They look so young, man. Looks like his sister. No, it's his mother. So how come he's on her backside like that? That's like illegal. And he, but like here we are, and there's Teddy, and he's in the prime of his life. He's like 2 and a half. That makes him like 20. I don't know. Like dog thing doesn't work anymore because like they used to die at 10. So it was 7 years to 1. They were dropped dead at 10. That was 7, the human. Now they live to like 26 with like Viagra and hair implants. You hear things with dogs now. It's frightening. My dog is 23. Oh, great. Cost me $39,000 last year to keep it alive. I hear stories like this. And these are not stupid people. They're not at all. I know. I mean, I know people who spend that kind of money. They had cancer and a cure to $39,000. God bless them. Unbelievable the kind of things people do. So where was I when I got so rudely interrupted? I got intertructed. Well, here's where I'm going with it. The preciousness of a berry, the preciousness of a dog, and the life that we lead, which is so wonderful in this great country of ours, the freedoms we have, and that there are people on earth who spend every waking minute trying to figure out how to kill us, harm us, and destroy other people. Their entire life from the morning they wake up until they go to sleep at night is how to kill, how to maim, how to hurt, and how to humiliate other people. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. We have a nation that spends millions of dollars to keep an alcoholic stew bum alive if he should trip and break his hand in the streets. EMS, the ambulances, and Mr. Smith, and how are you, and rush him to the hospital and around the, oh, get the oxygen. And there he is. Every life is precious. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars later, and there's the bum in the street puking on himself again 3 weeks later. Every life is precious, but at what cost, I ask myself. It's like everyone votes. Yeah, that really makes sense to me. It sure does. That's why we get the kind of leaders we have. Everyone votes. Like there are certain rules I would establish as to why everyone shouldn't vote. Like let's start with an IQ test. That would be the minimum. Okay, number one, speak English. You can't speak English, you don't vote. That means you don't know what's going on. You have no right to be in the country to begin with, but you don't want to learn a language. Then you don't have the right to vote. That's A. B, an IQ test. Minimum 100. Okay, 100. 100 IQ should be the breaking point. Number three, you're on welfare, you don't vote. Because you're only going to vote yourself a raise at the expense of those who are paying your salary. Okay? You lose the privileges that you had before you went on public assistance. That might save America right there. But then I think about life, man. You know, everything is so precious. And then we got people on this earth, radical Islamists. I never really encountered this in studying history going back perhaps until a time in history of Attila the Hun, who, let's say, ransacked every city and killed everyone in the city that he invaded. But to be facing an enemy of such barbarism is hard to believe for a society that is so, you would say, evolved, but it's actually quite barbaric itself. We in the West are living in a sort of post-Christian barbarism. Now, that's a very interesting topic that I wanted to get to. But the sexual liberation movement, the progressives, let's start with the progressives. What do they advocate? Sexual liberation. What has it led to? Homosexuality, transsexuality, bisexuality, abortion on demand, round-the-clock pornography, soft drugs, euthanasia for anyone who's not perfect. And so, therefore, we are living in this postmodern liberalism, which has become, in essence, a form of cultural barbarism. Under the guise of tolerance and acceptance, we are actually a barbaric civilization. And all of the traditions that we grew up with are being steamrolled over by these cultural degenerates. Abortions become the norm. Divorce becomes the norm. Pornography is acceptable. Drugging yourself is acceptable. Being a single mother is acceptable. Teenage sluts is acceptable. Bisexuality, homosexuality, transsexuality are considered lifestyle choices. And now the Dutch want to go a step further. It's not enough that they have sex museums and sex clubs. It's not enough that whores advertise their bodies in storefront windows. It's not enough that marijuana is legal. No, that's not good enough. It's not good enough that euthanasia is rampant in Holland going down to the age of 12. What are the last frontiers for the cultural degenerate barbarians? It's child pornography, and engaging in pedophilia. A new group, a new party called Charity, Freedom, and Diversity, with emphasis on the last word, because I've told you for years, I was the first one to tell you in my first book, The Savage Nation, that diversity is a code word for perversity. The newly formed Charity, Freedom, and Diversity Party advocates reducing the legal age for sex from 16 to 12. The Dutch pedophiles are also demanding that child pornography and sex with animals should be legal. They also said that citizens should be allowed to go naked in public. And their party platform is, we're going to shake The Hague awake. Now, their ultimate goal is to abolish any limits on the legal age for sex with any child at any age. Their argument is that a ban just makes children curious. This is the world in collapse. This is the West in collapse. This is the world that we are trying to make sense out of. It is impossible to make sense out of a cultural barbarism of this kind. And so when you hear the word progressive, or when you hear the word diversity, you've got to understand who is behind it. And you've got to understand what you're fighting for. And you've got to understand that this is connected to the rise of radical Islam throughout the West. They are absolutely part and parcel of the same exact situation. Now, let me explain that in more detail for those of you who want to hear it. How do I relate the rise of radical Islam with its restrictions, with its throwback mentality, and with its hatred and its murderous nature with the progressive movement in the West? It's quite simple. You have to think about biology to understand it. You have to think of the AIDS virus, which is symptomatic, actually symbolic, rather, of what I'm talking about. The AIDS virus is actually quite symbolic. It's a retrovirus, and it invades the body, but it doesn't really cause an infection for a while. It lays in wait. And while it lays in wait, the retrovirus, the HIV virus, it starts to attack the immune system itself. And only after the immune system itself is weakened can infections arise within the human being that has been infected with the HIV virus. This is what liberalism is. Liberalism is, in essence, the HIV virus. And it weakens the defense cells of a nation. What are the defense cells of a nation? Well, the church. They've attacked particularly the Catholic Church for 30 straight years. The police attacked for the last 50 straight years by the ACLU viruses. And the military attacked for the last 50 years by the Barbara Boxer viruses on our planet. And so when they weaken our defense cells, what happens is the opportunistic infections arise because our surveillance is not permitted. The reaction of our white blood cells is diminished because they're not permitted to react because they've been weakened by the liberal virus. And consequently, infections arise. So what are these infections? Well, you can name many of them. Now enter the arise of radical Islam into the Western world. How does that fit in? It is a counterpoint. It's actually part of God's plan, as I see it. I know this is shocking. Many of you can't follow where I'm going, but I'll go where I have to go in order to traverse through this jungle of thought. This is all part and parcel of God's plan. God is saying to us in the West, I have given you the Garden of Eden. I have given you the milk and the honey that is promised in the Bible. And you have despoiled the land I have given you. You have destroyed and despoiled the Garden of Eden that I have given you. And so therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce an element into this Garden of Eden so that you can see there are consequences to your behavior. And they are going to kill you. They're going to cut your throats. They're going to keep doing this until you realize how far you have gone astray. That's how I see it. It's amazing. But I mean, many of you don't want to accept this. Many of you want to think that radical Islam has arisen in a vacuum. It hasn't risen in a vacuum. It is arising as a counterpoint to the cultural barbarism of the West. Make no mistake about it. Yes, you can also include territorial expansionism, if you wish, meaning the desire for Islam to sweep across the planet as it had once done before when it conquered two-thirds of the planet through the sword and through the flame and through throat cutting. They're just doing it again, only this time they're achieving it not so much with the sword and the flame, but with the very techniques of liberalism that are in place in our societies that have gulled us and made us lay down our normal weapons of survival. Through the sword of tolerance, through the sword of acceptance, through the sword of liberalism, if you want to put it in that category, the radical Islamic movement is causing the greatest upheaval in our society and our Western societies that has been seen since the Industrial Revolution. We are going through, in essence, a radical religious revolution. And either the people in the West come to understand that they're going to disappear, their children will certainly not survive, or their grandchildren won't be here as we know it. They will not be here. If you take the arc we are on, and you see the kind of leadership that we don't have, and you see the kind of appeasement going on from our so-called hawkish leaders, I see a very terrible prognosis for our children.
Savage.
Did I tell you about the chestnut man? I didn't tell you about the chestnut. Oh, there were a lot of crazy people in those days that were on the streets. Well, today they are too, but they're holding microphones and they're working for CBS. So one of our subway rides, cold, nasty, miserable, snowy winter day, slush, 11 years old, dressed up like smoke coming out of your mouth that was so cold. Your face was red. Your hands could freeze if you took a glove off. I love that weather. So there was like a bimmy who sold chestnuts outside the I used to love the Museum of Natural History. I loved the Mastodon. I liked the gem collection. I didn't know it in those days. It shaped a lot of my future to show you the greatness of our culture. When I'd go to the Museum of Natural History as a kid and I saw exhibits of a natural scene from the Fiji Islands with birds, little did I know that years later I would actually seek out that kind of thing in my life professionally. Shaped, no doubt, in part by the great cultural institution of the Museum of Natural History. Of course, this is all lost today on the Islamo-fascists and the TV generation and the internet and iPod. I don't know what these children are going to become. What is their dream? What kind of dreams do these idiots have? I haven't any idea. It's very sad that children have no dreams, no nothing. They think everything's in, you know, like, oh, I'll give you another example. Oh, so the chestnut man, and I have another story from last night. I'm going to tell you the last night's story before the chestnut story. After work, I went on one of my one-hour walks around downtown San Francisco. I need to burn off energy. Hat tilted low, collar up, anonymous. No one knows me. Till I open my mouth, then heads turn. So I don't say anything. So I like to go and look into restaurants and bars, and I like seeing people going home and the hustle and bustle. It's kind of a fun thing. It's a conclusion of the day for me to see that in this gorgeous, beautiful city of San Francisco. So one of the places I stop in is like this Shishi Hotel. It's got a bar scene. I like to see the hubbub and the scene. I never liked the bar scene when I was young, and I'm not in the bar scene, but I like to watch it sitting in a lobby. So I'm sitting in a lobby on a chair, and the bar thing is over there. Hundreds of people, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the kids in their 30s all looking. Everyone's a seven in there, which is actually why it's more fun. They probably go home with each other. Sevens go home with each other. The nines and tens go home, you know, to psychopathic behavior. The sevens at least go home with each other because they don't think they're God. So it's a place packed with sevens, and I'm sitting in a chair outside in the lobby, and I'm watching the comings and goings. Every girl that comes through the lobby pulls out a cell phone, and even though they're alone, they're all looking in the cell phone, talking. They're making believe that they have somebody they're waiting for. That's the latest gimmick, and they think someone's buying into it, that if you pull out a cell phone, it means you missed the date's late, and you're there, and you're busy, and you're popular, and they're all staring in it like a text message. They're looking like inside a fortune teller's crystal to see if they can find a visage of the truth inside this little instrument in their hand is how it struck me. If I were like from another planet looking in, I said, what kind of madness is this? What kind of species is this that young females who are searching for husbands to settle down and have children are walking around with a device in their hand? Instead of talking to a man, they're talking to this device in their hand and looking at it and staring in it as though it's the Holy Grail itself. Now, to go back to the chestnuts in the open fire. We're outside the museum, freezing slush, cold, and one of these bimmies is selling chestnuts. And they're delicious. Man, they roast them out there. Do they still do that? I don't even know if they allow them anymore. And a guy, I'm with my friend, we're 11, and he turns out, he says to us, hey, you guy, he talked a weird voice. He was a big guy. He looked like the guy that George Michaels was allegedly cavorting with in a park there in London, got hushed up, like on the, you know, the rough trade type. But a little, like, lower class than that even, a little more nutty, and he says, hey, you kids want to see pictures of girls? So right away, I knew he was a dangerous guy. So we play him along. Yeah, 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 where do you got those pictures? You kids come with me. Come with me. It's only a subway ride. I'll show you those pictures. We didn't go with him, but we knew that he was a pervert.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
WOR, Jeff, you're on The Savage Nation. Where do you stand on the evolution question?
I believe that the nexus of science and theology is actually biblical and can be found in the actual words of the original Hebrew in the Bible. The very first word of the Bible, Bereshis in Hebrew, translated, actually mistranslated as in the beginning, is a testament to your position on God having created other existence prior to the existence related in Genesis. God says, Bereshis, it is buh. Buh is the indefinite article, not the definite article, the. It is in a beginning. It is the construct form grammatically.
Hold on, stop right there. Stop. You are a biblical scholar, I take it, Jeff. You read the original Hebrew?
Yes, I do.
So I assume you've had an education beyond high school?
In several disciplines.
So in the original Hebrew, the Bible says not in the beginning, but in a beginning?
In a beginning of God creating heaven and earth. The word created, and again, the appropriate exegesis of the language is a fact.
Hold on. Someone may not understand that word. You're not actually using the name of the Christian God. You said exegesis. You didn't say Jesus, correct?
No, I did not say Jesus. I said exegesis as an interpreter.
Okay. Well, that's a big word for many of my listeners, particularly those who don't believe in evolution.
Well, I guess if one's intelligence is correspondent with one's intellectual acumen and education, then such language is a function of ordinary conversation, isn't it?
So, Jeff, you are a biblical scholar, and where do you come out on evolution and God?
I believe that that God created humankind with the dynamic of evolution, with the ability to adapt to circumstances, situations, and to live with a sense of dynamic. God ordained us, God mandated us to subdue the universe. That is a declaration of learning science, becoming knowledgeable. The first element of creation is in a beginning. It's beginning. It's time. God first creates time. Then God creates, and creates, by the way, in Latin, refers to creatio ex nihilo, to create something out of nothing. And God creates heaven, transcendental space, and earth, physical space, time, space, continuum.
So why let me ask you a political question on this subject. Why is there a certain tendency now in certain quarters of America to reject evolution? Where is this coming from?
I believe that it threatens the intellectual ability to interpret and understand that there's a certain level of culpability that humankind has for its own actions.
In other words, they want to create everything is God's will. We have no free will. We're going back to where we're just automatons, where it's all preordained. Not only was man created out of whole cloth, but one's life is preordained as well. Does that go hand in hand with the people who are anti-evolution?
That is correct. There's a definite sense, almost of a predetermined, predisposed circumstance under which we relieve ourselves of liability and culpability for our own actions. I'm sorry.
So in other words, the very same retrograde tendencies that we see in radical Islam, where there is no free will, is now occurring in certain quarters in America? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. And I believe very much that to be the case. I believe that if you examine the nature of religious history and the evolution of religion, Islam itself is the result of evolution of religion. Muhammad took all of the religions available to him at the time. He took Christianity and made Jesus a prophet. He took Judaism and made Abraham and Moses prophets so that Islam would attract the Christians and the Jews. It was, in his mind, the ultimate evolutionary position of religious doctrine.
So we're having this seminar now on the Savage Nation, Jeff. Bible says God created the heaven and the earth, and he did so in 7 days. It does not say he experimented and created first the Neanderthal, etc. So now how do you answer those doubts and fears in a person?
The Bible indicates that God is proactive and responsive. I'm going to identify a narrative that takes place in the time of Moses. The children of Israel are with Moses in the desert, and God has given them the laws of inheritance. And the laws of inheritance are directed toward the sons of the fathers. And one of the families, the father's name is Tzelophehad, he has only daughters. And the daughters come to Moses, and they complain to Moses that they have been now excluded by virtue of their gender. Moses said, you know, that's a really great point. Let me check it out. He picks up the red phone. He calls God. He says, God, listen, we have a problem. These daughters of Tzelophehad are complaining about the laws of inheritance. What do I do? God says to Moses, you know what? They've got a valid position. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to change this and do this, and we're going to give them the right to inherit within these parameters. This is a God that is proactive, a God that is involved, is concerned, a God who adjusts. Now, it is our belief paradigm that God is omnipotent, God is all-powerful, God is omniscient, God knows everything, and that God is perfect. Well, if God is perfect, how can God make a mistake? And the answer is God does not make mistakes. The mistake is our misunderstanding and misinterpretation of that which God does. And absent a cumulative knowledge of the ancients, of the language, of the culture, the philosophy, and the theosophy, as well as the theology, far be it from any of us to assume that we have even the slightest inkling of what it is that God is doing. I had a bris the other day, and I was asked...
Explain what that means to the audience. That's a ritual circumcision.
Ritual circumcision, right? I'm sorry. And I was asked by several people there, what is it, Rabbi, what is it that God wants of us? What does God want? And I thought for a moment, and I said, you know, I have been studying God's words my entire life, and I cherish God's words, and I cherish God's poetry, and I cherish the beauty and the meaning of God's words. And I figured it out. I know what it is that God wants of us. May I share it with you?
Please.
God wants us to care about each other. Sounds very simple.
You know, I got to stop. I've got to stop right here because I happen to think your call was sent by God. I'm not saying that you're a mystical creature. I know you're real somewhere in New York. But when I woke up this morning, I was perplexed as to what I wanted to talk about today. And I couldn't form a real show. The news is boring fundamentally. It's not that interesting. So I was reverting to my comedic self, which always works because I can be a funny guy when I want to be and I'm in the right mood. And the people enjoy it. They need a break too. But, you know, the words that kept going through my mind from the morning shower onward all day long that I couldn't get out of my mind, Jeff, the words were man's inhumanity to man, man's inhumanity to man. This theme of man's inhumanity to man is what's playing out on television day and night. The world is descending into barbarism and into madness all over again. What we thought we left behind in the last century is coming back to haunt us, perhaps. I fear it'll be worse than the last century. In the last century, as you know, over 100 million people were slaughtered because of the false belief system called Marxism or communism. 100 million people were killed because of the false god of communism. God knows how many people are going to be killed in this century because of a religious conflict being instigated and fomented by psychotic imams around the planet. What is going to save us? If you are such a believer in God, do you think light will prevail? Do you think life will prevail? Or do you think that these throwbacks will drag the world back 1,000 years into darkness?
No, I think that one has to be optimistic, and one has to understand that optimism tempered with the realism of our very, very uncivilized civilization. We have lost our sense of civility, but we have not as yet fallen into the abyss of which you speak. I think we are certainly losing ground rather quickly. But I
how much worse does it get than Columbia University, under the guise of diversity, teaching these abominations to the children? Masochism, sadism, whipping people on the stage, and the so-called enlightened liberals like Bollinger, the president, say nothing about this. This is a once great university. Is this not a symbol of the decline and fall of the West?
I think that it's certainly a shout-out, to use the vernacular of the day, and a very coarse and abrupt reminder that we've got to reassess and reevaluate our moral compass and get back on line here. We've got to learn that our future as a human race, our future as a civilization, is very much a function of our ability to reintegrate a sense of decency and kindness and culture that is rooted in understanding the divinity that is manifest in every human being.
Yes. Well, to me, I let flies out of a screen, for example. It's not because I know the fly. It's because I understand the DNA in that fly. I understand the complexity of the fly. I've seen the fly under a microscope. I've looked at a fly's eye under a microscope as a child. I understand a fly's wing, what a miraculous creation a fly is. And so, therefore, if the fly doesn't bother me, why not let it out of the room? To me, it's a way of making a prayer to God himself when I let a fly out of a room. I don't know if anyone can understand that. Maybe they think I'm, you know, crazy by saying a thing like that. But I don't need to kill a fly, in other words, just for the sake of killing a fly. If I'm walking and I see ants, must I crush the ant? Or if I have the choice, can I step over the ant? Why do I step over the ant? Does the ant bother me? Who put the ant on the planet? What is the ant doing, after all? The ant is doing his own business, minding his own business. So I tread lightly on the earth. But I will tell you that I see people who have no regard for human life, no regard for humanity. They would wash this earth in blood in the name of their false god. And I wonder if we in the West have not become too delicate for this battle. This is a religious time in America, as you know, the Christian world. Although it seems to be about shopping, it's also about worshiping the Lord Jesus Christ for the Christian people. A benevolent religion, the greatest religion the world has ever seen in its modern form in terms of civility. I think you would have to agree with that. There's no other religion on earth that permits every other religion to function within it with such benevolence, in my opinion. I have a question for you to think about, because you're the man I want the answer to, and just bear with me. The radical Muslim says that the West is corrupt and degenerate and sexually obsessed, and therefore we must all be butchered. And he wants to bring back the word of God. So he does so how? By insulting God, by slaughtering people and torturing them and cutting their heads off. Could God actually want people who are immoral to be killed in order to purify the world? And if that is so, what is more immoral? Sexual excess or murdering and slaughtering an innocent?
Three things very quickly to answer your question. Number one, the transgression of Sodom and Gomorrah was a function of man's inhumanity to man, and Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed.
Wait a minute. So in other words, when a man behaves in such a manner, or a woman behaves in such a manner as described, they are committing inhumanity to themselves and to other men.
That is correct.
These are inhuman acts.
These are inhuman acts, and these are acts that are a function of a lack of respect for the divinity that is manifest in each and every one of us.
So when we hear that such activity is diversity and that we should all open ourselves up to it, we're hearing is the word of the lie, the word of the devil.
Savage.
I want to talk about North Beach, California. Unlike other shows, The Savage Nation is an ongoing serial. Each day relates to the day and the days that preceded the day that I am on the air. It's one long serial, you know, like The Lone Ranger Rides Again, Boys and Girls Come Back to This Theater Tomorrow for another serial. That's what I do, because it's my life and my view of the world. It's one man's opinion is all it is. Nobody writes my script. I live it. I eat it. I breathe it. I think it. I'm an American. This is what I'm going through. But at the same time that I'm interested in politics, I'm living a life. So I inject the real life 101 into the political view, and then you have to decide whether you like me and whether you want to listen to me and whether you agree with me or disagree with me. That's all. And that's why every day that I get up, I say, you know, you got to tell it like it is, man. Don't get weak. Don't falter. So I get off the air last night, and I go for a walk. I actually loved it. I had to put on a leather jacket, a scarf, and I walk through the streets. I walk past where that Muslim driver mowed down 17 people right to the spot. And I started walking up California Street. It was like, you know, early evening. People were still rushing home, rushing out of the big, beautiful buildings. And I walk all the way up the hill, and I hit Grant Avenue. I was going to go all the way to the top, and I figured it's enough for the first day. And I turn right on Grant Avenue, which is Chinatown. Then I start looking at the stores, and I see old stores there. And you see these family businesses, 100 years, some of them. They haven't changed the sign because the grandfather owned was smart enough to own the building. He bought the dirt. He bought the bricks. And he passed it on to the next generation and the next and the next. And the kids went to Berkeley or wherever. And they're successful. They didn't blow anyone up. They didn't say, I hate America. They did it the good old American way, which is the way my people did it. And I inherited nothing, by the way. And well, I can't say I inherited nothing. Financially, I inherited nothing. But I inherited more than money, which was a work ethic, number one. And the most important thing I inherited from my father was a desire, not an insistence on honesty. He got insanely angry if I bullcrapped him. If I said one thing that wasn't, that he thought I was giving him the BS, he would go nuts. He turned red-faced. To him, the truth was the most important thing. Now, I miss the mark every day. Don't think I'm an angel because I'm not. I try my best, though. It's almost impossible in this world to be 100%. So anyway, I walk through the Chinatown. I'm looking at the storefronts, and I'm looking at the businesses and the knickknacks. And I stop in front of a Chinese knickknack store. And strangely enough, there was a Chinese gentleman about my age. Didn't know. He had his hands behind his back, and he was leaning over looking at an outdoor display of little tiny indoor water fountains that were making all sorts of preposterous waterfalls. And this, I don't know, we just looked at them. We both knew we wouldn't buy them. And I felt it as though I was living in the 1100s in Shanghai somewhere, because I knew that sometime in the past, you know, 1,000 years ago, somebody looked at little water fountains in a store in Shanghai. And I walked on down Grant Avenue, coming across Broadway into the alleged Italian district, because it kind of, they blur right now, like a New York Canal Street used to be the dividing line into Mulberry Street, you know, across from Chinatown. Same kind of thing here. And it is largely still Italian. Now, here's the interesting part to me. I'm in one of my Moulin Rouge melancholic moods, which is basically who I am, because I think that life is melancholic. I don't think life is particularly ecstatic. And I'm not on drugs. Let me tell you that right now. Legal or illegal, I don't use them. I'm in one of my moods. That's all, meaning I'm me. This is how mankind is. Man is basically that way. The construct of the positive thinking happy male is an anomaly. It's a fiction, by the way, created by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. But that's my opinion. I don't think mankind is fundamentally a happy animal. I think man is kind of a, you know, brooding animal, if you want to know what I think man really is. I think the rest is an invention. Anyway, dogs are happy. Mankind isn't. At least my dogs are happy because they live the life of Riley. So in the all of a sudden, in the middle of the honk, honk, beep, beep, people coming, people going, and the smell of garlic coming out of the restaurant, I hear, I said, am I going crazy? It was like an auditory hallucination. I hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. What am I, crazy? Am I hearing not Moulin Rouge, I'm hearing La Vie en Rose. And I said, what the heck? How could this be? How can I hear La Vie en Rose in the middle of all of this? Because the last I heard it was like, my sister's playing the piano a long time ago, and my father, may he rest in peace, was singing by the piano. I never heard it since, La Vie en Rose, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, I must be going crazy. Maybe I'm just, you know, thinking about something. I walk up the street. There's a guy with a violin in front of an Italian restaurant, dressed in a tuxedo, playing badly La Vie en Rose. I said, oh, my God. No one knew what he was playing. So I said to him, La Vie en Rose. And he nods, and I give him a $5 bill, and I walk on.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The National Academy of Sciences, so-called, came out in the morning and said that the Earth is the warmest it's been in 400 years. Then by the end of the day, they said it's the warmest it's been in 1,000 years. And by midnight, they corrected it and said it's the warmest it's been in 2,000 years. And it's all because of us, mankind, and that the science is in. That's rubbish. Many scientists disagree. And what the other scientists are doing are looking at snapshots, not the whole moving picture. Now, one of the chief scientists that I listen to is a professor and geographer named Harm de Blij, B-L-I-J, who wrote a book called Geography Matters. And he is speaking about global warming and cooling. Please listen to clip 28.
It got even warmer without our help in the Eemian than it is today. Sea level was 15 feet higher at the top of the Eemian than it is today. And it is an uncomfortable truth that if you take a look at those graphs, there's a very good chance we will be facing that again, whether or not we contribute to the pollution of the atmosphere.
Whether or not we contribute to the pollution of the atmosphere. I hope you understand that. And we're just in the middle of a cycle that's getting hotter. Now, so listen to 24.
About 25 million years ago, glaciers begin to form in the highlands, even in the tropics, in New Guinea, in the Andes, Kilimanjaro. About 12 million years ago, the Arctic Ocean freezes over and stayed frozen over. And then, in a period, a time frame called the Pliocene, there is a plunge of temperatures from about 6 to about 1.8 million years ago, when that incredible cooling came close to wiping out humanity, the primates, our common ancestors, but survived in Africa, not in Eurasia. And then 1.8 million years ago, it has been cold like this for 100,000 years. Then the temperature rises precipitously. Well, that's not a very good word. Suddenly, up to warm conditions of the kind we're experiencing today, that warm period tends to last somewhere between 8 and 13,000 years. Then there is an equally precipitous drop, and it is cold again. Now, notice these glaciations that are happening here have their kind of warm intervals as well. But then there's another one of these warm periods, and then it drops again. This has happened now about 18 times over the past 1.8 million years.
Now, I understand many of you can't follow it or don't want to follow it. I also understand many of you are college-educated or reasonably well-educated on your own and can follow it. It's common sense. This is not too complicated. Now, we then go on to Professor de Blij's discourse that I think is fascinating. Listen to 26.
Just 18,000 years ago, and I know this is not news to anyone in this audience, ice stood as far south as the Ohio River. My house in Cape Cod would not have survived. And it came down very quickly, and it receded very quickly. The reason the United States is the breadbasket it is because those glaciers scoured rock in Canada into the finest powder imaginable, shoved it all into our Midwest, and then the ice retreated, leaving us with some of the Earth's most fertile soils. I'm surprised the Canadians haven't demanded reparations. This is where all this fertility came from.
See, he's the kind of science professor that I loved. First of all, he's knowledgeable. Secondly, he can explain it in common terms that we can understand. And he's basing it upon real evidence, which he was showing there. I'm going to leave out the real science behind what he's saying. This is not opinion. You can say it's theory based upon evidence. Let's put it to you that way. But it certainly counters the absurdity of the National Academy of Sciences that we're the hottest in 400 years, and we did it. Now, go on to 27.
Just when it looked as though Europe was going to get itself organized, that its wealth and its cities were going to become the centers of democratic governments, it's already begun to happen in Iceland and one or two other northern places, the climatic roof fell in. And in a matter of not generations, but years, Europe was transformed. The agricultural frontier, which was in Scandinavia and included Iceland, there was settlement in Greenland. Greenland wasn't called Greenland for fun. It was called Greenland because it was a green tip of a very cold place. And then all of a sudden, climate switched over. It had to have to do something with the thermal halon circulation in the ocean and North Atlantic Ocean, obviously. But in any case, what happened was, priests prayed with their congregations at the faces of glaciers advancing out of the alpine valleys, gobbling up villages and churches and farms and fields. It was as many a diary I have read, because wine growers were keeping diaries in those days, because they, more than anybody else, were sensitive to climate change. They all wrote and said it was like lava coming out of a volcano. That's how glaciation impacts.
So it happened rapidly. It changed the face of Europe. And so what we may be going through now is another rapid change, and now we're going to a hot phase. And we could see real hot temperatures that are going to change the face of humanity. I don't doubt that we will. But for God's sakes, can we stop being primitives about it? Gore is sort of a priest of a gospel of lies, that we did it. This is part of the narcissism of the liberal, who thinks that he does everything. It's like a baby who makes doo-doo in his diaper and says doo-doo. Al Gore is saying, in essence, we made the doo-doo and we're suffering as a result of it. Only we could do it. He doesn't understand that we have almost nothing to do with the change, the climactic change that we're going through right now. It's, again, a form of egomania that the liberal, of course, relates to, because they live in a world of narcissism and egomania, where only they can affect things. Not God, certainly, and not nature. They're better and they're more supreme. Do you understand the psychopathology of the liberal and why I said liberalism is a mental disorder? It's even affecting their view of climate change. Now, I am giving you a lesson that you could get nowhere else. I don't believe that what I'm doing for you in the last 5 minutes could be done at any university in America today, not only because it wouldn't be done, but it couldn't be done. I'm giving you a nugget on global warming in this segment that you have found nowhere else. You won't find it anywhere else. It's worth everything on earth. It's going to enlighten you and give you a power and a strength that don't you understand that knowledge is power? But we're living through a kind of mass hysteria in the United States of America and in the West in general. A mass hysteria that we're evil, that we're no good. They won't blame the Islamo-fascists for what they're doing. It's our fault. They won't accept the fact that it may not be our fault that we're going through a hot spell or a warm spell. Again, it's our fault. The evils of the West. Don't you see how it all ties in to the mass hysteria of the illiberal left? Don't you see that this is an emotional reaction that ties into the psychopathology of the liberal or the leftist? Now let's go on to 29. This is the most important segment of all.
We are now contributing to a worsening of the global warming that nature probably had in store for us anyway. And as you know, really the only question is the degree of anthropogenic warming that we're adding to the natural warming. So perhaps you've been reading in the scientific literature, there was a great article in Science the other day about intensification of solar radiation. Apparently we're going through flares and hotter time. And we're adding this enormous pollution to the atmosphere, which of course has now so enhanced the greenhouse effect that we don't know what lies in store. Let me just suggest this. The atmosphere has been has been filled with carbon dioxide in the past to a far greater degree than is the case today, and has come back and cleansed itself after continental drift, thousands of volcanoes, after the impact in 72,500 years ago when humanity was nearly wiped out by a volcano in Indonesia called Toba. Take a look at Toba on your computer sometime. You will learn some amazing things. It probably cost us incredible human diversity, gene diversity, and almost wiped us out. The atmosphere apparently was completely covered in soot for 17 years, but repaired itself. After the asteroid impact in Yucatan, surely there was no chance that the atmosphere would recover, and it did.
You hear all of this? Do you hear the brilliance of the simplicity tied together here? This is like the verbal brushstrokes of a master. And I've always known, ever since I was a young science student, that the full professor who knew what he was talking about always explained things in ways that I could understand it and the other children could understand it who wanted to learn, and that the assistant professor would cover the blackboard with data and drawings and diagrams, and he would say things and tell you to study and memorize, and you were going to get a test, and you didn't understand anything. And that is because the assistant professor was an ignoramus who didn't understand the topic himself. That only the full professor truly understood, the good ones, what he was talking about, and usually could explain it in simple terms. Which, of course, this is how I learned to be a great communicator, or from the great professors that I had. And I had some really good ones. I had great high school teachers in my day at Jamaica High School in Queens. In those days, I had really some great teachers. And so, therefore, talk radio in some ways, although it's a medium of entertainment, it's also potentially a medium of great learning, whether you know it or not. And this edutainment that we have here is a golden opportunity to please stop being superstitious about what's going on here. Please stop supporting the absurdity that we're so important that we're killing ourselves by driving our cars. This is rubbish. Pure rubbish, hysteria, ties right into the psychopathology of the liberal mindset, which is, of course, obsessed with its own power and importance.
Savage.
The debate in the scientific community is completely over now. There is no more debate about the fact that it's real. We're causing it. The consequences are bad, headed toward catastrophic. We need to fix it, and it's not too late.
We're in an ice age. It's been going on for tens of millions of years. Ice ages consist of surges of cold temperature that last a long time, but not surges that keep the planet cold all the time. There are times of moderation in between. And then these peaks when it suddenly gets almost Cretaceous in its warmth. And for hundreds of thousands of years.
Almost gets Cretaceous in its warmth for hundreds of thousands of years. What a brilliant sentence, Cretaceous in its warmth. I may have an aversion to hot places because the Cretaceous was a dangerous place. I may have some distant ancestral memory of time in the Cretaceous. I think the dinosaurs were around then, weren't they? The proto-liberal was around, the dinosaurs, the pterodactyl. But, you know, you listen to a guy like Gore, he's always been known to a man that was imbalanced. And said he invented the internet. I mean, he's an imbalanced man. He looks it, sounds it, and he's a faker. It's Al Gore's theory that he's promoting. He says the science is over. There's no longer a debate. He's a liar. There is a debate. How could he make such a definitive statement? There is no debate, and we caused it. When there are many scientists who don't agree with that, it's unbelievable to me. So I think I've put to rest at least one thing. Be open-minded. At least say to yourself, you know what, at least I learned from Savage there is debate. And I'll be open-minded about it. You know, keep your mind a little open. Don't become a closed-minded jerk and think that what you're reading about in the newspapers or whatnot, for you hear from Al Gore, is true. Be open-minded. You heard the professor, and we're going through a phase now, and we're treating it. Oh, listen to clip 30. Here's the most frightening one. Here it comes.
On the basis of the statistics, we're due for a precipitous retreat. into a cold climate, into a cold world, which will be far more challenging to deal with than a warm world. And we should be prepared for great, that's one of the reasons I use climate change. It's one of the great challenges. It would level playing, it would level geopolitical battlefields in ways we have never encountered before, and we are probably on the verge of it.
Did you hear what he just said? It will level the geopolitical playing field, and we're on the verge of it. And we're going into a colder phase, which will be far harder to deal with than warming. That's amazing. So get out your mucklucks. Don't throw away your underwear. And get ready for the Ice Age. Maybe we can learn something from the Inuits. Well, I really love doing this piece. I really love it. I'll tell you, this is what I guess I'm doing what I really want to do today. I try to do everything I want to do every day anyway, understanding that there's a lot more to be learned than you may think, not only about the hypothesis of global warming and climate in general, but about the war, about everything that you hear about. Please be open-minded. Don't walk around didactically and say, this is it and we know. Leave that to me. Only I can do that.
Savage.
Families don't appreciate you as much as audiences do. Because you get off the air, it's like, boom, the mic goes off. You come on, it's like, ordinary Joe. The only one who's there for you is your dog. Yeah. They take, oh, you know, you try to tell them what you did on the radio. Oh, a big deal. You've been doing it 15 years out of a migraine or my day was. No, that's the way. You know, it's like any other job to families. You don't understand what it's like in talk show business. No one really cares what you do in your family. They heard it already. How many times can they listen to you? No, it's a tremendous letdown. You ask anyone in talk radio, he'll tell you the truth. They come home and they think that their family's going to be their audience. The family could care less. The kids are watching TV if they're young. The wife is probably getting her nails done. Oh, listen to what I said, and it was so brilliant, and they called me from telling me, yeah, all right, fine. Can you take the garbage out? Thanks for calling the show. But you got to get used to it. It's called humility. Ultimately, though, there's something to be said for dropping your ego and dropping your pride when you get around your family. It's not easy to do. It's called humility, my friend, because they're going to be the only. Tell me who's going to be there when you're in the emergency room, your audience or your spouse? Who's going to be there for you when your eye goes out and you're laying there after a CAT scan? Who's going to be out there? Who's going to be there putting a cover over you, covering your nakedness, as it is that they're instructed to do in the Bible? Cover the nakedness of your father. Who's going to be there for you? Your audience?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Pastor John C. Hagee is a phenomenal speaker. I've seen him on television. I've been electrified by his preachings. I want to tell you something. I would say this is one of the most electrifying and important moments in my radio career. I'm very happy that he's with us right now. Pastor Hagee, welcome to The Savage Nation.
It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Now, Mr. Hagee, what you're saying, I totally agree with. And you quote Zechariah, where you say that Zechariah in the Bible states that there will be a massive exchange of weapons. Can you please, for the audience, some of whom are Christians, some of whom are not, tell us what Zechariah, where it is written, and what it states?
In the 12th chapter of the book of Zechariah, the Bible says, and this is the plague. You understand, this is a prophet seeing something that's happening in the future that he doesn't have the capacity to give a mental registry of. He said, and this is the plague that the Lord shall send against all nations that come to battle against Jerusalem, that while they yet stand on their feet, the flesh shall melt from their bones, the eyes shall melt in their sockets, and their tongues in the mouth. That is a very accurate description of what happens to the human body in the presence of a nuclear blast whenever 150,000 degrees of Fahrenheit heat is created in a fraction of a second. Those who saw the ABC presentation of Nagasaki saw that with the pop cracker A-bomb that we have now, with its limited capacities compared to what we have now, this exact thing happened. But Zechariah nails it with such frightening accuracy, there can be no doubt that there is going to be, in the future, a nuclear explosion in the Middle East.
Now, Pastor Hagee, you referenced this, and I believe in prophecy, and I myself have read much prophecy in the Old Testament, whether it be Isaiah or some of the others. Who is it that gets this meltdown? Is it the enemy of Western civilization, or who?
Here is what's going to happen and the sequence that is going to happen. I'm going to go an inch deep and a mile wide because you could bog down and you'd be here until midnight. But the next thing that's going to happen in the Middle East, according to the writings of Ezekiel in the 38th and 39th chapter, in the 36th chapter, God tells Ezekiel that the nation of Israel is going to come and be a nation again. And the thing that makes that unique is that Israel is in Babylonian captivity. In the 37th chapter, there's a valley full of dry bones. Those dry bones rise up and become an exceeding great army. And in that 37th chapter, I think about the 11th verse, God makes that very clear that these bones are the whole house of Israel. There is no doubt about who this is talking about. And I say that because I've heard some Christian pastors preach this text as the resurrection of church. This has absolutely nothing to do with the resurrection of church. And then in the 38th...
Wait, Pastor Hagee, let's talk about this. I'm looking right out of it, and I agree with you. It says it was full of bones, and he caused me to pass by them, blah, blah, blah. And he said, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Then he said unto me, prophesy over these bones, and say unto them, O you dry bones, hear the word of the Lord, and blah, and the bones become living. To me, it's a metaphor for the descendants of the survivors of the children of those who died in the Holocaust. Those are the dry bones from the valley of death. It's the children of the Holocaust survivors in Israel who are fighting for Israel's survival right now, to me, are those dry bones. Does that, in your mind, make sense?
Well, it makes sense to this regard, that when you read that text, and it's in the King James Version, and the King James Version is always the most accurate when it comes to a rendering of the of a Hebrew and Greek text, it says that the bones were very dry, meaning that they had been dead for a great length of time. And in classical theology, that is meant to it is meant to define and describe the diaspora that began at 70 AD, whenever Titus came from Rome and he attacked Jerusalem for the first time. And Josephus says 1.1 million Jewish people died, and he took 70,000 with him back to Rome to build the Colosseum. That was the beginning of the diaspora, and the Jewish state was not reborn until May 15, 1948. So for 1,800 plus years, almost 2,000 years, the nation, as a nation, was not in control of their destiny. There was always a Jewish presence in Israel, but as a people, they did not control their destiny.
But in Ezekiel, when he says, behold, I open up your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, they don't mean that literally, obviously. I mean, we are people of the modern times. We don't believe that the bones literally become reanimated, do we?
No, no. It is a metaphor, but you see, you go back to the 36th chapter, and he says, I will bring you out of your Gentile graves. And he's talking about the Gentile nations to which the Jews of the world have been taken. What he is describing is that I'm going to bring you back to the land of Israel. I'm going to restore you as a nation, and you are going to be an exceeding great army. You're going to be a strong and bold and aggressive people.
Okay, so what happens next, Pastor Hagee?
In Ezekiel 38 and 39, there's the description of the Gog and the Magog war. And in this description of the Gog and Magog war, that there is the king of the north, which is Russia, that ingratiates themselves to the Islamic nations, and those Islamic nations are going to join Russia as they come into a military attack on Israel. It will be a massive land war. The Bible says that the army will be so large that it comes as a cloud to cover the land. The payoff for Russia is that Russia will get the oil out of the Middle East to become a superpower. The payoff for the radical Islamics is that they get to crush Israel and to control Jerusalem. And the nations there, I believe, in about verse 5 are listed, and Persia is...
I cannot believe it. Yes, right here, 38, verse 5, it says, Persia, Cush, and put with them all of them with shield and helmet. Who is Cush?
Cush represents the Arabian Peninsula, of that is represents the Arabic people that presently today are involved in the land that's controlled by Gaddafi and people like that. When you Persia is modern day Iran, and that they're very easy to identify. And he's defining Gomer there, which is Germany, and Tushgomer, which is Turkey, and those are going to come together with Russia against Israel. And in the end of the 38th chapter and the start of the 39th chapter, God makes it very clear that he's going to destroy that army. It's going to be the most awesome, sensational demonstration of God's power on the face of the earth since God destroyed Pharaoh's army as they pursued Moses and the children of Israel. And once again, it's going to be the hand of God saving Israel. The nations of the world are going to see that massive army coming and saying, this is the end of Israel. And even all the people of Israel are going to believe that's just the end of Israel. But God says, I'm going to leave in 39:1 or 2, I'm going to leave but a sixth part of thee. That means 5 out of 6 of you are going to be killed. That's 82%. And I'm going to leave 1/6 so that they can go to the uttermost parts of the earth and say that we went down to fight against the people of Israel, and the God of Israel destroyed us, and we were destroyed on the hills of Israel by a supernatural power beyond anything the world has ever seen before. The result in Israel is that there is going to be a spiritual awakening. You read there several times in the 39th chapter that, and then they shall know that I am the Lord their God. That statement is made several times in that chapter, and that is the whole purpose that God is allowing this thing to happen, that he may have a spiritual awakening of the people of Israel, that he, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is still in charge of the earth. He is still the God that called Abraham and that led Moses. And he's the God of their forefathers. And there's going to be a spiritual awakening in the nation of Israel as they return to their spiritual roots.
Pastor Hagee, I want to, with you, please listen to 23. And I want you to interpret this for me, because this gets tricky for me to do as a commercial radio host. And the nations shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they broke faith with me, and I hid my face from them, so I gave them into the hand of their adversaries, and they fell all of them by the sword. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions did I unto them, and I hid my face from them. It sounds to me as though God smites all of them. Where is the hope here?
You're talking about a historical thing there. What God is referring to there is that God brought the Jewish people into a time of judgment from the time of A.D. 70 until 1948 because that they as a people turned their back upon the Lord himself. And when we talk about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Israel invited into its camp Baal worship. Baal worship was idol worship. It was a very corrupt theology system, and there was always in Israel that corrupt strand of theology that kept Israel from being a follower of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God allowed the Jewish people from 70 A.D. until 1948 to go through the hell and the horror of the Holocaust and other things to bring them back to Israel, and then finally this war that's going to happen is to bring them back to him. When you stop to look at this story, God is saying, I'm bringing you back to your spiritual source, and which is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm bringing you back to Israel to reinitiate the people that you are, and you are going to have a heart for me like the God, like your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
And they shall bear their shame and all their breach of faith. In other words, God is really angry. You take a look, and I'm sorry to have to say this right now, but the day this war broke out, the very day that this war broke out, there was a plan for a gay and lesbian parade in Jerusalem. You know that, don't you, Pastor Hagee?
That's true.
And not only the Jewish, but the Christian and the Muslims were offended by this spitting in the face of the Lord. And I see a direct relationship between this dancing to Baal, dancing and worshiping the golden calf, throwing away the connection to the roots of Israel itself, which is God, and becoming just like any other Mediterranean nation, a desire to simply be another Mediterranean nation. This attempt to break free of the past of religiosity, meaning a connection to God, is why, again, this is happening. Pastor, I'm going to reread Ezekiel tonight as though I've never read it before. I'm no biblical expert, and I've never studied theology. I'm just a man who looks at the Bible from time to time. But the prophecy in this prophet's words of Ezekiel that you have just pointed out to me is alarming in the sense that there are countries named that will come unto Israel, including Persia, Cush, and Put, Gomer, and Togarmah. But if I read on to 39, Ezekiel 39:6, and it says, I will send a fire on Magog, and on them that dwell safely in the isles, I-S-L-E-S. Pastor, who in the world are they referring to when they say those that dwell safely in the isles? Do you have any idea who that might be?
No. There's a controversy as to who that might be. You're reading there where God is getting ready to send an earthquake to the world. And that reads in the King James Version that the islands of the sea will disappear. Now, which islands? Is that Hawaii? Is that a small island? What is being described there is a moment in time, actually, when the geography of the world will literally be restructured because of this huge earthquake. I believe it will be the earthquake in which the Temple Mount will be destroyed. The Book of Revelation describes a river that flows from the out of the Temple Mount down toward the Dead Sea in Israel with fresh water, and that beside this river on either side there are trees of life in which people eat the fruit of that tree. There are 12 different kinds of trees, and they eat that fruit of for one different tree for every month, and that those trees and the fruit that they bear bring to them supernatural health. This is something that happens in the millennial reign whenever Jesus Christ is ruling the earth. But there is going to be an earthquake that is going to literally restructure and reshape the geography of the earth.
It's interesting that you read the prophecy to say that Iran, then Persia, would join with Russia, or Russia would join with Persia. That's astonishing. But some of my listeners who are political geniuses have told me all along that the Islamo-fascist assault upon the West is really a design of the old communist bloc, that China, which is strangely silent during this Islamo-fascism, Russia, which is strangely not on our side during this Islamo-fascism, they are actually manipulating the Islamo-fascism. Pastor John C. Hagee, I'm going to look for you on television. I hope you can come back as a regular visitor to the Savage Nation to interpret the scriptures for us during these troubling times.
Savage.
Here's another topic about divorce I want to talk about, because an interesting fact came out. First of all, you hear when people get married, they say it's 50% chance it's going to end in divorce. It's not true. It's now 57% people stay together 57% of the time. So it's really 40% of divorces end in marriages end in divorce. That's number one. And that's new. That you got to understand is that you have that wrong. They're trying to destroy marriage. But there are certain factors, according to a study, that can raise the odds of the divorce to as high as 70% or lower the chance of divorce to nearly 20%. An average couple now has a 57% chance of seeing their 15th wedding anniversary. And if they make it that far, most will reach till death do us part. You can laugh at it if you want, but that's the way it is. So according to this study, what are the risk factors? Age. If they're just out of high school, that raises the odds of divorce. If they're older, if you're marrying over age 35, it also raises the chance of divorce, right? What else? Well, here's interesting. This is an interesting one. If the parents of these people had a divorce, the odds of them getting divorced go up. That's an interesting one. And I think that's a very important one because the children somehow are related to it. And then money is an important one. Money helps an awful lot. If they're poor, the chances of divorce go very, very high, way up, obviously. But here's the funny part. Well-off couples divorce over personality conflicts, and very often they'll do it at the drop of a hat. Now, religion does matter to a certain extent. Catholics who practice Catholicism have the lowest rate of divorce of religious people in the Christian community. Protestants have the highest. Now, here's an interesting one that you never heard of, that I've known all along, because I'm very outspoken and loud. Before the parents divorced, did they yell at each other? Was the conflict between the parents loud and visible to the children? Or did the parents keep their conflict behind closed doors? Take a guess which kind of parents increase the likelihood that the child will get divorced. Of course, the sneaks. The children of the parents who keep their conflict hushed up behind closed doors are those children who divorce more frequently because they don't trust their relationships. While the children who heard it and the screaming and the yelling, and then it led to a divorce, at least they knew where they were at and they know what a relationship really is. And they have a lower rate of divorce, incidentally. I'm not surprised by that at all. But I thought I would share that with you on the Savage Nation because, I mean, divorce is, you know, everywhere, so you may as well talk about it. The world is so horrendous, you may as well stick to the things that are simple to talk about, like divorce.
Savage.